I did something wrong. Hold on.
This is episode number 254, which is an amazing episode. Kristen, one of your former bosses is on.
Mm-hmm. Rob Niederhorst.
Rob Niederhorst, Rob as well as Alex Nice, who's also an amazing person. Two different people both came together to talk about the amazing work they did together on a film called
John Wick 3.
Yes, John Wick Chapter 3. Amazing film, which is pretty cool. But I've known both of them for a long, long time, and really cool guys. Rob Niederhorst was the overall visual effects supervisor on it, and Alex Nice was senior illustrator, art director on it, and designed a really incredible part of the set, the all glass room part of the whole thing. So it was really cool for them to talk about it and talk about the challenges and visual effects. What are some of the things that you liked about it?
Well, one was that how the stylized world made it more acceptable for all the killings. So that was cool. Yeah. But what Alex did with the glass house was awesome. I read one of the articles and like how he created it, and it took like a year or something.
Yeah.
And he created like the avatars or the henchmen so people could do the VR experience in that.
Right.
And then Rob creating the alley with scanning it and having Alex go and find the nastiest alley in what, LA?
Yeah.
So that was, I liked all that. It was a good podcast.
It was a great podcast. The two of them are really cool and really creative, and I think they think about the aesthetics a lot. And it was really beautiful. Honestly speaking, I think the show was really interesting. The whole idea of John Wick is a very interesting idea and really well executed. And I think that Rob and Alex were really great, great people to have on that project. So really cool to have that. Okay. I really appreciate them being on. Let's talk about some announcements.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on?
All right, so we actually just have one announcement right now, and you can find this at chaosgroup.com/events. This is happening December 12th through 13th in the Netherlands. It's the 3D Base Camp Benelux 2019, so you can join V-Ray experts, and they'll be there for in-depth V-Ray workshops at this SketchUp-themed event.
Great, absolutely cool. We also want to note that this is basically the end of the year, so we want to make sure to wish everyone happy holidays as they go forward. There's going to be a lot of great stuff coming up in 2020. Kristen and I and everyone actually in the office are heavily investing and spending a lot of time planning for Total Chaos 2020, which is going to be happening in May.
Mm-hmm.
So we're excited for that to be happening. So keep an eye out for that. But besides all of those things, what are some of the things that people can find out more about us? About CG Garage?
So you can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. Podcast or go to chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Right. If you guys want to reach out to us in an email and ask more questions or give us any ideas, just go to labs@chaosgroup.com. And of course, we always appreciate any kind of reviews you can give us on Apple Podcasts. Just go to Apple Podcasts and give us a review. That being said, please enjoy this incredible episode with Rob Niederhorst.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernel.
Why didn't you go with the rosemary water?
I couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Because it means something if you start drinking stuff like that.
If you then drink you rosemary water, is it too L.A.?
It is a little bit too L.A. It's like it's exactly like
as opposed to vitamin water.
Yeah, because it's just a sweet drink, you know.
Vitamin water is pretty much just a rebrand of Gatorade.
It is, yeah. I remember when vitamin water first came out, and there'd be guys giving it away for free on the sidewalk, and they'd be like, it's really good for you, bro. It's vitamins, right? Because that's what they say on there.
Right,
there's
but
probably vitamins in it.
Yeah, it's good.
Do you remember when we you and I were starting Speed Shape, and we got a bunch of vitamin water, and we were like, this is just basically sugar.
Yeah. Oh, it's sugar water. Yeah. No question about it. But then there was the purple one. I think that was like the 50 cent sponsored one or whatever. And yes. It was delicious.
Very good.
I drank way too many of those because it was awesome.
But you see, that rosemary water, although it's probably ridiculously overpriced because it's pretty much just water with a few essence of rosemary in it.
Yeah. A couple of drops.
Tastes good, though.
It tastes delicious. Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yep. There you go.
Wow, produced in the UK. It's flown all the way from the UK.
So I bet you it takes that much gas of that bottle to bring that bottle here.
Oh, yeah. The carbon footprint of this bottle is so high, I should be embarrassed by drinking this.
Yeah.
But I have to finish it because if I don't, now I've wasted this carbon footprint.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. There you go. Excellent. All right, guys. As you probably gathered, we already started on this, but
yeah,
I'm concerned about that. You're concerned about that. You guys haven't been in the room since the remodel.
It's
fancy now, right?
It is fancy.
Wasn't it just like pretty much a couch and a chair and a computer?
And that was it? And yeah. It was that way. Now we're all around a table and we can actually look at each other a lot more easily.
Yeah, it's cool. It's handy.
It's handy. It was good. I was excited about it. I was sitting there and I was talking to Lon, and we were talking about John Wick, and I had not actually seen John Wick, and we were specifically talking about it because there was we were going to do it a Martini Giant episode about it, right? Because you guys know David Strapenis?
Mm-hmm. I do, yes.
I was driving down 2 days ago. I was driving down Sunset, and I see a black Tesla in front of me, and the license plate says LA VFX. And I said, I bet you that's David Strapenis.
Yeah.
So David wants to be on Martini Giant, and I told that to Thrawn, and he goes, oh, he wants to talk about John Wick. I'm sure he wants to talk about John Wick. So I told that story to Lon, and he goes, we should get Throb and Alex on because, shit, man, these guys have been on. They're friends of ours. And you guys were very, very involved in John Wick 3, both of you.
Yeah.
Right?
We were.
Yeah. So that I hadn't seen it, so I decided to just freaking binge watch and watch all of them, which I was hesitant to do because there's something about the movies from a faraway perception that I was like, I don't really care about it. I watched I Am Totally in This World. I love this John Wick stuff. And
did you have a break in between watching them, or did you do like a whole day of watching all three of them?
No, I took one day at a time.
Okay. That's a lot, because that's a lot at once.
It is a lot at once. It's a lot of killing. And the thing is, the killing part was not necessarily as interesting to me. It was the world that was interesting to me.
Mm. Like, the world building is excellent.
The world building is really interesting. And that's something that I didn't get from my perception of John Wick.
Nobody was prepared for that when they did the first one.
Right.
I mean, obviously, Chad and Keanu knew what they were trying to do, but they just made it for fun. Like, hey, we got a script about some crazy assassin dude. Let's make a movie.
Right.
As like a joke, almost.
Really?
And then it became a real movie and made pretty good money.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was unexpected, right?
It
was
totally.
What was it made for?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I think it was it made way more than it cost to create.
Yeah,
it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It was, I was very surprised by how much I got into it. And then what happens is that once you, because like you said, I took a day between each one. When you stop watching that movie, that world or that taste of that world stays with you.
Mm. Mm, interesting.
You know, like you drive your car differently. Every motion with your hand feels like it's a purpose.
Do you find that you exit parking lots at a high rate of speed and then just lay on the parking brake?
Nope. No. It's very methodical. Like, because there's no threat in my life at all. But so I feel like I'm being very methodical.
Yeah.
And I was like, and just things are prettier. Like, there's something about that world that's so pretty. So pretty.
I mean, it's art directed to within an inch of its life.
The cinematography in those movies is incredible.
Yeah.
Also.
In every single one, even though the cinematographer changed from part one to part two.
Right.
You know, the photography in all the films are incredible. And I'm, you know, for me, part three, I think is, I mean, what I've personally worked on, part three is the best looking film I've ever worked on. Like bar none, nothing touches it.
I mean, it's phenomenal. I had worked on that, it would be definitely in that top movie. Yeah. Although, I mean, honestly, Tron was really a beautiful film that I worked on as well.
Yeah,
and I think that has, there's some similarities of the framing and the aesthetic and the contrast. The contrast is what really is amazing in those things.
And not being afraid of color at all. That's one of the things, when I first went on to that, it was like I was making desaturated images. He's like, no, we want color. This is a color movie that has, like, you know, its own style. Is the, you know, if you look in the windows of a lot of the scenes, it's a green light that's shining in from the city. It's not just regular, you know, city lights, which is really cool. It's like a artistic, like, stylization thing. It's really cool.
Right.
And to me, that level of stylization actually helps pull the viewer into the alternate reality, which is why it doesn't get the level of flack that some of the other super violent movies get. John Wick kills 182 people in part three. That's a lot of killing.
Yeah.
I mean, even on my daily commute, I don't kill that many people. I, you know, it's like 125. I run over as many people as I can.
Yeah.
But he kills a lot of people, and it's a super violent movie, but it doesn't get the level of flack because it lives in this alternate universe, and because they world build, it kind of gets a pass.
Oh, it gets a lot of passes. And I gave it a lot of passes. Yeah,
but
like I don't go in the middle of Grand Central Station and stab two people and just walk away.
You should. It is super fun. Yeah, I mean that. I think really that's why it does get a pass, and it's why people who review the film don't. They take it as its own thing.
Right.
And they don't make comparisons to other super violent movies because. While you can believe that world is real, you don't equate it to
reality.
The real world.
It's not reality.
Yes.
It's fantasy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's absolute fantasy. That's an awesome thing. Obviously, there's a lot of references to The Matrix.
For good reason.
For good reason. Yeah. Like guns, a lot of guns. That was a good line.
Yeah, that line was hotly debated and almost didn't make it in the movie.
Yeah, really?
Well, yeah. There was one person who didn't want it in, and then there was somebody else who really wanted it in.
Right. And you know, just having Lawrence Fishburne in there as well was kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it was the 20-year anniversary of The Matrix. And so that's why there were a little more homages.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Cool. It all kind of came together.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's interesting. All right. Well, let's get into this because I know we're just going to keep talking about details and details, and we can keep going. But let's talk a little bit about your roles and where you guys came in. Which of the two of you who came into the movie? You guys probably came in around the same time, or
no?
Oh, I was about a half a year before.
Yeah.
You, right.
Yeah.
Right. So tell us a little bit about how you got into it and how you came into this movie.
Yeah. So I was working. Am I too far away? I was working on two projects at the beginning, I think, of 2018, I think it was.
Okay.
And then I got called to go work on another one of Chad's projects out there. And then so we were at Manhattan Beach for about a half of a year doing design work on that first movie, and then it transferred over into John Wick because of scheduling issues. And
okay.
So I went on to John Wick, and I actually hadn't seen any of the John Wick films at that point either. So I've been binge watched a couple of them also.
Right.
And then kind of got into the world. And by the end of the project, I was like super into it.
Cause
it was
like,
it was, you kind of really get into it when you kind of look at the intricacies of what it is.
Yeah.
And so, I was there for about 6 months in LA, and then eventually went out to New York, and then did another 3 to 4 months in New York, I believe it was. And then you came on in New York, or you came on in out here in LA?
They hired me out here in LA, but then I started.
That was the first time I saw you was in New York.
Yeah, in January, I think.
Yeah.
January of 2018.
Okay.
Right.
So you were designing a lot of the concepts.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what were some of the big ideas and concepts that you were sort of focused on?
I was doing a lot of just general concept work of like environments and set design stuff, but it was early on And then after probably about a month of being on it, just doing traditional concept illustration mm-hmm. work, the production designer, Kevin Cavanaugh, asked me to see if I could kind of port one of the big sets that we had in the film over into virtual reality so that we could design a set in VR.
Okay.
And use that as kind of like a tool. Because if you've seen the film, there's a big giant glass structure called yes. the glass office. And it's such an abstract kind of crazy set that building that set for virtual reality had a lot of like uses that would kind of play out throughout the production.
Okay.
And so I initially told him that I wasn't going to be able to do it because glass obviously is an issue in regular rendering, and then real time I thought of, yeah, and then I thought an actual environment made of glass was never going to work. And then I started building it and things were working with it, and I just kept going with it, and then it became this kind of massive project that kind of went through the whole entire production.
So I'm going to ask you about that, because I dealt with a glass environment specifically on Tron right when the light bike sequence, and it was a ray tracing nightmare to deal with that stuff, right? You need, if you do the ray tracing correctly, you're actually fine. But I remember specifically when, if you guys remember from Tron, that there's under levels where you have a ceiling of glass and a floor of glass, right? And, you know, I had to correct Fresnel in there. As, you know, I'm very strict about that. and I was sitting there with Joe in the screening room, and I basically gave him a wedge of like, how many bounces of reflections are we going to have? And it was a freaking fun house of insanity when we put like, you know, 12 or 15 bounces of reflection.
It becomes a mirror almost, right?
Well, it's just like, you don't know where the top and bottom is. So we actually had to restrict and taper off the reflections. We gradient it so that you could know where the actual top and bottoms are. How did you deal with that?
So, I mean, I would break it up into, like, there's the visual aspect of it and dealing with the ray tracing.
Yeah, because you dealt, they built that.
Yeah, so it was going to be a physical set from the start.
Right.
But really the VR wasn't a look development thing, it was a layout thing.
It was a layout thing.
Yeah, so, the way that I dealt with it in VR is obviously the old 90s way, which is opacity maps and gradients, right?
Right.
And so that's what I did. I didn't even touch any of the ray tracing stuff because it was never an option for 90
frames. But I would think that you were, yeah, of course, not of course, I absolutely agree. But I think that the look of the reflection of the glass was important to them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But that would be, I mean, that came later, and that came part of as the illustration concept side.
Okay.
And then the VR was more of the layout and design side.
Got it.
Because it is such a like a abstract place. Like imagine wrapping your head around what you're going to do in a place that you can't even see in, you know, concept art or renders. It's really difficult. So that was why we did it in VR. And it went through a lot of design changes. It was originally 4 levels, then 3 levels, then 2 levels, and a lot of that kind of like development stuff to get it to figure out what they were going to do and kind of balancing cost and whatnot.
Okay. But they built it. That must have been amazing to see that.
It was an amazing process to see it happen. Like when you hear the person pricing out glass by the tonnage, it's in like the steel by the tonnage, and figuring out the space and figuring out, you know, the height of your soundstage to see how big you can actually build this building.
Right.
I mean, there's so much stuff involved with it. It's really like when I look at that thing, I don't understand how it got made. Like there's no reasonable reason why something like that should be made for a film, and it happened. It's so awesome to me.
To add to that.
That's gotta be a challenge on the visual effects side.
So I'll definitely talk about the visual effects, but to add to that, basically all the spec, the real hard spec was we have to put a crew on glass with camera gear. Oh, and by the way, there's a bunch of dudes throwing stuff and throwing each other on the glass. So the glass could hold 150 pounds per square foot.
Right.
That was the thing. So you couldn't have 5 big people stand in 1 square foot area because that would be bad.
Right.
The glass was, 3 inches thick or 2.5, somewhere around there?
I can't remember.
It was super thick.
Was it triple pane, I think?
Triple pane, yeah. Super low iron. We did iron wedges. You know, they got different types of glass.
Explain that.
Because depending on the iron level is where it goes green, right? If you have a lot of iron in glass, it goes green. And right. So they're like, how much iron do we want in the glass? Low iron, medium, high, whatever. I think they had four or five
and
different levels.
And that changes the strength of the glass, right?
No, it just changes the color.
Okay.
The amount of tempering changes the strength.
Right.
But they had a glass manufacturer. And at some point, I believe the guy's name was Maynard.
No. I don't remember his name, but I remember you talking about the samples that came in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're like, okay, guys, here's the deal. So if we don't make the decision to build this thing in the next 12 calendar days, the glass manufacturer cannot make enough glass
right.
to do this at all.
Right.
We have engineering problems.
Right.
Like we have to build something that has to be fought upon. And a camera has to stand next to these people.
Yeah.
And
this is an architecture problem.
It's a serious, it's an architectural and engineering problem.
Right, right.
So, you know, the art department had to, I mean, the work that you guys did in the art department and everybody, like major kudos
right.
to the amount of actual like super brain power that had to go into that. It's one of the craziest things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't cover it a lot. I talk about how difficult it was to actually get something like that built. Like I'm surprised they didn't have a documentary on it, on the making of or whatever.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. It was,
well, we have a podcast at least.
But I mean, one of the other things also was insurance too, like insurance to have Keanu Reeves running around on that glass.
On glass.
Yeah. And I also remember, maybe I shouldn't tell this story. I'll tell it. But I think there was a safety guy. You know, they go in before they actually shoot the thing, and they have a safety guy walk around on the set. Should I not talk about this?
It's super funny.
I can cut it out if you want to.
So they had a safety guy. Maybe you tell the story, actually. Were you there?
I think I was near there.
I've heard about it, but I wasn't there.
Yeah, basically, so the safety guy goes and checks out the set, as they do with all sets. They have to go and make sure that everything's cool, and if safe, the railings right. have to be certain codes, and it's a whole situation.
Sure.
So before the crew can set foot on it, it has been cleared by the safety inspection officer for the studio.
Right.
And there's all kinds of varieties of things they have to follow. Anyway, so the safety guy forgets that, or doesn't see that there's no glass wall, and falls right off the set. So the exact thing that everyone was concerned about happening
happened to the safety guy.
Happened to the safety guy. And everyone, almost everyone, I know I did it, everybody at least once walked into a glass wall.
Oh, I'm sure.
At damn near full speed. Yeah. Hey, let me just turn, boom. Okay. Yep. I did that. I think I want to say day two that I was on the set, just looking around and like, okay, planning this and seeing, you know, if we're going to shoot here, how much reflection is there.
I'm sure I would have, would have walked away with so many bruises on my face.
That was definitely a solid face print of mine on one of the panes of glass yeah. by one of the samurai outfits.
Okay. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
What was your Windex budget?
Amazingly enough.
Yeah.
So, I can't.
How many squeegee guys were there?
There were a couple of squeegee guys
yeah.
who would constantly clean the glass between takes, between setups, everything. Yeah. They did an incredible job.
Walking around in booties also.
Everybody walked in booties all the time on that set so that mm-hmm. we wouldn't leave scuff marks.
Yep.
And any scuff marks that were left by, you know, the actual
action.
Yeah. The talent that was on camera.
Yep.
That was a whole situation. And then I made everybody wear black.
How many days on that? Right, because of reflection.
Because everybody started showing up and I'm like, okay, guys, you can't wear the hot pink Hawaii shirt because nobody in the John Wick universe wears hot pink. I can't get away with this. And so a company memo went out and I said, everybody wear black. And so everybody wore black. And so as a result, the amount of reflected crew you see is very minimal.
I was looking for it. Couldn't find it.
Oh, and the other crazy thing about that whole thing is the translight also, the city backdrop beyond the glass also.
I was going to ask about that. Go ahead and tell me about that.
I mean, yeah, what was the length of that thing? It was insane. It went basically a fabric printed city backdrop that was three stories tall that went around the entire
set
and then was backlit by, I guess, translight stuff or whatever, hanging lights. And
it's a giant translight. It was massive.
Like just a big giant fabric backdrop that was in there, which was really crazy because there's one perspective, obviously, on one of those backdrops.
Yeah.
So there's certain areas that when you're walking around in the set, looks right. Other areas in the extreme corners of that thing, perspective's obviously off, which I'm assuming you guys ended up resolving
those problems.
Yes, right. The VFX would fix those problems. But what was really interesting is that in the VR set too, because we have this set built to scale in the actual soundstage model in there also, so that we know it's going to fit in there. And then we put the backdrop on it. You can see, walk around in VR in the set and see where the actual backdrop broke. So you knew ahead of time,
you could pre-plan your shoots.
Exactly.
Your angles.
Yeah. You can see where that backdrop was not going to work. And that could have helped a lot in the planning of a lot of the shots, I think also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's amazing. And I think it's great that you guys built the set. And I think that's really important. I remember when I was on Oblivion and they were going to do like, you know, his little apartment in the sky thing.
Yeah.
And they said that, was like, oh, we'll just do green screen. It's like, green screen? It reflects everything. And so we basically built a virtual, because we had the model of the building. It was like, we showed them a rendering and ray traced it. It's like, it's green fucking everywhere because it's not a good idea to green screen reflections.
In fact, I called Joe when they were talking about Translight versus projections and the whole thing. And I said, hey, man. Tell me a story.
Tell me about Oblivion.
Tell me about this and, you know, how did you guys do this, et cetera, et cetera. So I got a good download from
Joe about it.
Joey K.
Yeah.
About that.
That's cool. And I think it's important because I think it's one of the reasons I started to really think about this story being a really cool story is the fact that, you know, from the designer to the set to the VFX and how you guys actually all work together to try to figure out how you're going to make this work. I'm sure you guys had some battles to figure it out as you were going along, but trying to make the real world work and make the visual effects help that narrative is really cool. Really cool. All right. So let's get into it. What were some of the challenges with that?
With
a lot of it. So you tried to, the first thing I think is important is visual effects actually tries to minimize the amount of work they have to do. Right?
Yeah,
so you started with everyone wears black.
Yeah. So my role is to mitigate problems.
Right.
That is the role of a visual effects supervisor. You have to make everything look good. That is a goes without saying part of the job.
Sure.
Right. But the bus driver has to drive the bus. Very simple.
Right.
But then it's okay. How can I make this look photographic with minimal impact during production?
Right.
And causing as little problems as humanly possible during post-production.
Right.
Because if I make minimal impact during production, but all of a sudden we spend an extra 10 weeks on post-production, then I won't be working on this movie very much longer.
Right.
Or any other movie when people find out about that.
Right.
So that is my job, is to go, okay, well, what I have to see, you know, 6 to 8 months in the future to know what kind of problems we're going to run into.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my experience on the vendor side really kind of came into play.
Right.
Where in this movie, and I guess, should I do a spoiler alert? Because I'm going to tell.
Oh, no, we should just totally spoil it.
Okay. So spoiler alert. So turn it off. Spoiler alert. So at some point, John Wick has to cut his finger off to prove his fealty to the High Table.
Right.
And at some point, somebody said, let's put a green sock on him. And I said, let's not do that. Let's put a black finger condom on him. And everybody said, well, that's weird. Why would you do that? And I said, what color of clothing does everyone wear in this movie?
Right.
And everybody said,
black.
Black. And I said, yep. So when his hand flies around a lot and it goes over the inky blackness of New York City night,
it's going to be green everywhere.
Or, you know, suits, you're going to see the green. I have to paint that out. But if it's black and I don't see it, I don't have to paint it out.
And then you just stick to roto at that point.
Yeah. And but the cleanup is really minimal.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I have to clean up. I mean, there are shots in the movie where if you were to really step frame through them and really gamma them up, you can see the finger condom. But if you don't do that, and nobody does that, then you don't ever see it. There are shots that we didn't need to
remove the finger because you don't notice it.
Because you don't notice it unless you really crank it.
Right.
It's only times when like a light would hit it a certain way.
Brilliant.
Something like that. Or, you know, there's a close-up of where he looks at his hand.
Yeah.
The camera's looking straight up at him, and he looks at his hand like he's contemplating his decision that he made.
Yeah.
Thinking, okay, you know, I just cut my finger off because I'm trying to stay true to my wife, and he made me give him the ring, and now I'm about to go against the high table, et cetera.
Right.
So anyway, that's all to say that my job is to mitigate problems and to see in the future.
Yeah.
And my biggest challenge is then, you know, managing that process and all the personalities involved with that process, and then even outside of that process, including the AD department and the editorial department, et cetera.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, those are choices that I think that people don't necessarily see. Like, you remember, like in IRL when we did that, right? And when we were sitting in Daniel Buck's driveway, mm-hmm. and we were sitting there with a DP who knows we're all visual effects people. And then he says, aren't you going to put green screen behind there? And he goes, no, that's too much work. We're just going to put white sheets back there and just blow it out. Yep. And then we don't have to do anything.
Yep.
And he goes, but you guys can do it real easy. He goes, well, we know how much work it is, and now we don't have to do any of it.
So in the current movie that I'm working on now, we did exactly that for a ton of scenes.
For driving and stuff like that?
Or no, just for people, they're in a house, they're just hanging out talking, mm-hmm. and they just put a giant silk behind it and put a bunch of lights on it. And it looks like it's bright sunlight outside, and you would never know it's in a soundstage in Atlanta.
Right.
And it's, you know, 105 degrees outside and everybody's sweating like crazy. But inside, it's just somebody's sitting in a house in Connecticut somewhere.
Right. Exactly.
Yep.
Well, those are smart tricks that I think that people should think about. Like, not everything can be answered with visual effects, right? You can do some really cool things that look great without necessarily needing to do a bunch of CG on it. But I'm sure you had to do some CG on the glass set.
Yeah. You know, my job is to mitigate problems. And so what I tell every director that I'm looking to work with, I said, my goal is when you're done with principal photography that you fire me because I have nothing to do.
Right.
I know that that's not the case, but that is my dream. My dream is that we don't do visual effects because they'd never look as real as photography.
Right.
Having said all that, we do an incredible amount of planning to make sure that what we deliver is, I don't like the word photoreal because it implies that it's not real.
Right.
I use photographic. So I actually want to use actual camera data, and I want to use actual data that is completely realistic. So for example, when John is having a conversation with Winston and it's on this rooftop, that rooftop is completely fabricated, actually designed by this guy over here, Mr. Alex Nice.
Yeah.
With a beautiful water fountain that you did not think was going to make it in the movie, but
I love that water fountain.
It's a beautiful water fountain. It looks awesome. And at any rate, so the whole idea is where does it live? Well, it lives somewhere in Manhattan. It lives in the financial district.
Okay.
Well, let's take a look. Actually, this place can't live there because there is no place for us to shoot this at all. And John Wick 2, they shot it over at Rockefeller Plaza, but apparently lighting it was a real pain in the rumpus.
Yes.
Purely because of just continuity. So,
it was a golden hour sunset.
It was golden. Yeah. And how do you take a really long scene and shoot it at golden hour? You don't, is the answer to that question. Right. So, Dan Lauston, who was the director of photography on both John Wick 2 and this current one, Parabellum, he said, guys, we're just going to shoot it on stage. And I said, okay, well, as long as I can get all the data I need, I want to be able to recreate your lighting, but on digital versions of the elements that live there. So all the buildings, et cetera, et cetera. So we took a scanner to what was the Continental, one Hansen, not one Hansen. Cocoa Exchange.
Cocoa Exchange.
Yeah, so we got permission to go on the roof of the Cocoa Exchange, and which is an apartment building.
Uh-huh.
And so we got the LiDAR scanner out, and I got my HDRI kit out, and then we got an actual Arri Alexa out, and we shot massive pantiles, HDRs, photogrammetry,
right,
full LiDAR scanning. The LiDAR data set was extreme.
Okay.
It was a lot of stuff. So when you look outside where they're having that confrontation between the high table and Winston and John,
uh-huh,
what you see out there is about 95% reality.
Okay.
It just had to be created. And we moved a couple of buildings around because you would never get light through the giant cluster of tall buildings that are right there in the financial district.
Okay. So it is virtual though.
It is virtual and very heavily based on photography.
Right.
Yeah. Including actual Arri Alexa photography that we then mapped onto buildings, but then moved a few buildings around for cosmetic purposes.
Yeah. Because you can't ask New York to move buildings for you.
No, right? They got really annoyed when you start trying to move buildings around.
Bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a whole thing. But that's, you know, we did that a lot. For example, at the very end, when John falls off of that roof and then lands into the alley, mm-hmm. I remembered that I had worked actually with Kevin Cavanaugh on another film called Roman J. Israel, and they had shot in this really gross alley in downtown LA.
Uh-huh.
And I said, wait a minute, I know a guy who lives in downtown LA. Ring, ring. Hello, this is Alex.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, Alex, do you live near a really gross alley?
I'm
going
to interject and say, had I known that I was going to be walking through some of the most disgusting alleys I've ever been in my life, I probably wouldn't have agreed to do this.
So I had him go take a few photos.
Really?
Yeah, because I lived there. I went to all the alleys that are in the historic area, you know, near Skid Row and everything. And I went into these alleyways and... I mean, I don't want to gross out the listeners, but there's some terrible things going on in those alleyways. Shot there also.
Yeah, the thing that you think is happening in the alley is happening in the alley. There's no question. God. So just come up with bad stuff and I did see it actually.
Yeah.
So we say, okay, we want to be in an alley. So what are we going to do? We're not going to make a CG alley. We're going to make a real alley digitally.
Okay.
So we went, scanned it, photogrammetry, we did the whole thing.
So you scanned a gross alley.
We scanned a really disgusting alley, and the gentleman, there's about five or six people that live in that alley. One of the guys who I guess is the head dude, his name is Cleveland, very nice man, who at some point I said, okay, hey, Cleveland, would you do me a favor? I got to scan stuff and I can't have a bunch of people moving around. Would you mind? What if I buy you guys lunch? Would you guys mind cruising out of here for, I need an hour and a half. Is it cool? I said, I know this is your home.
Yeah.
I don't want to displace you in a bad way. So I'm happy to buy you lunch. If you need some stuff, let me hook you up. And he goes, no problem. Happy to do it.
So he got the other guys?
So he got the other guys. They all got out of there. And I think one of the guys there
went to Musso and Frank's or something?
You know, of course. Yes, it was Lobster Thermidor for everybody. But yeah, so I got those guys a couple of bucks and they went and got some food. And at some point, Cleveland comes back and he's like, so what are y'all doing over here? Uh-huh. And, you know, I told him, I said, look, we're scanning because we're going to put this in a movie. And he's like, man, you people are crazy. I said, why is that, Cleveland? He goes, this alley is the most disgusting alley in all of Los Angeles. And all you guys just want to come over here and put cameras. It's disgusting. Why would you want to do that?
It's like, actually, we don't want to put cameras in here. We just want to scan it so we don't have to put cameras in here.
Right. But yet I spent a good 4 to 5 hours in there.
I'm sure.
Yep.
Not regular rats, super rats.
Super rats. Yeah. And one of the shop owners, I think who owns a jewelry store that's right there, I think is right next door to it.
Yeah.
He came out one time because he was pouring basically bleach and Lysol with, you know, diluted in water all around the alley to get rid of the smell. And other physical things that you
have in an alley.
That you would have in an alley of that type.
Yeah.
And at some point he's like, how long are you guys going to be here? Because my customers don't like to show up in my store when my store smells like human excrement. And we said,
you were not doing that.
No. But when it happens.
Yeah. I bet.
3 to 4 times an hour.
Right.
You can't get the smell out of there unless you're constantly cleaning
bleaching.
But anyway, I've kind of tangented a little bit. But
so
yes.
But what you did basically is you digitized that area so that you wouldn't have to shoot there.
Correct. Yeah, because we couldn't.
You can't. There's physical problems with shooting there, right?
Physical limitations, actor availability limitations, et cetera. And at some point, you know, it is cheaper for visual effects to make up a shot than it is to get the cameras, get the actors, get the cinematographer, get everybody, because the cinematographer is in Denmark. Some people are in LA. Some people may be in New York. You got to travel everybody. You have to pay per diem. It's like there's a whole situation.
Yeah. That's a real tricky, challenging shot also, right?
It is, yeah. And it had to be choreographed very specifically.
So what were the actors were on a giant green screen and then you comped it in?
Yeah. So the shot, we shot a real stuntman landing on a roof that was all very well calculated by the stunt department.
Right.
And, you know, for anybody who thinks the stunt department does not take these things seriously, boy, are they wrong. These guys measure everything, and it is very well tested.
Yes.
Like extensively tested. The safety is very key.
Yeah.
And at some point things were shut down because somebody's like, this is not safe. One of the stunt guys, the stunt coordinator said, well, hold on. We need to figure this out because it feels unsafe.
Right.
And so they would change some things around about certain things. But anyway, I saw Jackson Spadel, who is John Wick's stunt double, basically fall to his death, quote unquote, from like a 40-foot platform.
Jesus.
All the way down into this cantilevered glass roof onto something that was across the alley, which was also a cantilevered balcony where all the railings were made of this rubberized material, so it would all collapse.
Right.
And then he has to jump from there to another cantilevered piece, and then that cantilevered piece gives way, and then he lands on the ground.
Wow.
I watched him do it. Those had to be done in two pieces. Just purely for safety reasons.
Yeah. Which is why the John Wick movies are kind of amazing, is the stunts also, right? They're not hiding things. They show the stunts being, they use the stuntman and the ability that they're able to achieve those things.
Yeah.
Is crazy.
Yeah. Yep. And yeah, I mean, they did that falling stunt. I think they did 4 takes of it. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
That hurts. That's gotta hurt.
And every time I'd go to Jackson, because I got to know him a little bit, and I said, how you doing? He's like, I'm fine. I'm like, you can't be fine. This is crazy.
Right.
It's just kind of what he does.
Yeah.
That's just his thing. But I mean, he doubles Ryan Reynolds for Deadpool. He's that guy. He's one of the more prolific stunt performers out there.
That's amazing.
Super talented guy. Extremely nice human.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible. All right. Well, let's talk about the glass. How do you deal with glass in CG? You had to have used some CG in there.
Yeah. So we had our friends over at Method Australia. They were the ones who
Those were the used to be
Allura.
Allura. Yeah. Now they're called Method Australia. Yeah. Nice guys.
Great, great team. The thing that's awesome about the crew at Method Australia is that they've just been working together for so long that they clearly have a built-in language between the crew so that the work just comes out good earlier. Because everybody has an idea of who does what.
Sure.
Now, I don't have any confirmation of that, by the way, but it just feels that way when I get the work.
Right.
And also when I'm on CineSyncs with them and I deal with phone calls with them, I get the feeling like they know each other extremely well, and there's no, everything's politics, but there's no crazy political infighting at that place.
Sure.
You know, no more than any other place, but at least the supervisors get along in a really great way, and they have a really good level of camaraderie amongst themselves.
Yeah.
And they delivered excellent work, and they were the ones who did that alley.
The alley sequence
yep. as well as the rooftop.
Okay.
And you know, it wasn't easy. It was a difficult problem to solve, but the glass office, they handled that stuff. And, every once in a while we would extend a little bit here and there. But what we did at some point is we just put a roof on it and just made sure we didn't see through any more glass. We did a test and, we put a roof on it. We had different levels. Actually, you did the concept for that, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Explain that, Alex. What do you mean?
Well, on the set, there was no rooftop, I think, so that they can get the overhead shots in the fighting. Is that why there was no roof, or was initially, it a visual effects?
Initially, there was no roof because they wanted to put a third floor of glass over.
That's right. Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Because we ran out of time to build a third floor of glass.
Right.
And so the idea was, how do we put a third floor of glass in there? Well, visual effects can do it. Of course we can. It's, you know, it's no big deal. It's just some render time and some amazing artists doing amazing work.
Right.
And then at some point we said, well, what if we just put a regular roof on there and it just looks kind of cool?
Looked better.
Will anybody notice it? And we showed it to Chad Stahelski, the director, and he's like, this is great. And so then we closed it off. So it actually cut down render times dramatically by just having a glossy reflection on there versus massive amounts of refraction and actual glass.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's cool.
Yeah, but then when people get kicked into glass and that smashes, that most of that was rendered.
Really?
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't notice. That's good. Thank you.
Well, explain that.
So we had,
there's several things I noticed, right? Yeah. So with the glass, I mean, the glass is unpredictable.
Yep.
Right. I can imagine it's unpredictable, but there were so many things in there that were like, you know, when the blades hit the glass and the cracks in the glass and all that stuff, it's like, there's no way, like I know instinctively that there's no way you can plan that physically.
Correct.
But it looks 100% believable.
I mean, that's, you know, hopefully we do our jobs well, and that's the
and the other thing that you guys did is that, like, I must be right. Like all the cracks in the glass from the blades and stuff, that's all CG.
Yep. Correct.
What really sold it for me, and you guys really nailed, is the warping. Like as people bumped into glass.
That's real. Because people are actually bumping into the glass.
I know, but the cracks warped correctly.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you hire great people who are great artists and care.
It really sold it because that's what made that, it was really good. Okay, so sorry. I didn't mean to distract.
No, it's all good.
I got excited about the glass.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize how much of it was CG. So explain why was it CG?
So one of the bigger glass moments is when Wick is getting kicked into the glass cabinets that have the skulls in there.
Yes.
And so I was on the Verrazano Bridge because we were shooting the motorcycle chase.
Oh, yes, which is also amazing. I want to get to the motorcycle chase.
Right. So I was there, and they were shooting that moment of John getting kicked into the glass cabinets. And I get a phone call from my producer, Kerry Joseph, and he's like, "Hey, Bobbo." And I said, "What's up?" He goes, "I'm going to send you a video." And he sends me a video. And the video is of Jackson Spadell, who's the, as I mentioned before, the stunt double, getting kicked into the glass. And the first one breaks because they put charges in there and it looks great. And then the second one, the charge doesn't go off. So he just knocks it over. And then it kind of dominoes. And so now things topple, but that's not cool. He's not getting kicked into it. The glass is just kind of smashing and it's whatever. And so you can see.
They weren't using sugar glass or?
It's Alfonso's glass. Right. It's all made to break, et cetera, et cetera. But they put charges in there. At the very bottom, they're charges that we painted out. So you never see them in the final film.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And so as somebody gets kicked into the glass, they blow the glass.
Right.
So it makes, because the glass just doesn't do that. That's just not how that works.
Right.
It just doesn't break that way. You have to blow the crap out of it.
I know, but it looks cool though.
That's movies. I mean, look, we got a guy killing 182 people. You know, we got to go with the flow.
Keep going. I'm with you.
Yeah. So at any rate, because that didn't work so well, the biggest issue with glass is reset time. So glass breaks on set, it is a massive cleanup process because you can't just like broom it away. Yeah, you have to broom it, but then you have to mop it. And you have to make sure there's no glass anywhere, because if anybody gets hurt, now you've got a massive insurance liability, as you kind of mentioned earlier, Alex.
Right.
And so it's a 30 to 45, maybe even an hour of reset time.
After every glass break.
So guess how many glass breaks we did after that thing didn't work out?
Right.
Almost none. We did one. We did one glass break because somebody was like, "God, we have so much glass. We have to blow the glass. This is crazy."
Right.
But that's why we ended up doing a lot of glass break in CG. Even the antique warehouse where the knife fight is, the antique warehouse knife fight.
Yeah.
All of that glass is 100% digital. There is never one actual real pane of glass, even in the cabinets, ever. Not ever. And it was taken out for safety purposes and for reset time purposes. Because if you need to have somebody do that same thing over and over and over, which is exactly how these shoots happen.
Yep.
Because they're choreographed extensively by...
To the frame.
Subframe. yeah. Without question. They are highly choreographed and things have to move a certain way, which is why these movies have a flow and it is ballet.
Yeah.
You know, so the fact that there's actually a ballerina in here, there's a lot of meta things going on.
Oh, yeah.
But the whole idea of having digital glass is to avoid that reset time. It's like, okay, well, let's shoot some glass breaking as elements so that our visual effects teams know what that looks like.
Right.
I need them to have realistic glass breakage just for reference.
Right.
I don't ever have to see them do that. And I don't actually look at turntables, to be honest with you. I'm not a big fan of those.
Right.
I want to see stuff in context. Mm-hmm. The audience of a film very rarely sees turntables.
Right.
So I don't think anybody's ever seen a turntable. And so
I've seen turntables.
Well, yeah, but not while you're watching a movie.
I've seen turntables of hailstones.
Yeah. All right. Yep. All right. Oh yeah. I've seen those too. Oh boy. Yeah. We worked in the same project. Yeah. Yeah. So we ended up, doing real glass breakages, but we shot
for
a
reference.
Film as for reference.
For reference.
And then at some point one, like John actually physically kicks a dude who goes through a cabinet and that is a real glass explosion.
Okay.
Yep. And that happens one time, but everything else, the glass is all digital.
Okay.
Yep.
So every time he crashes into a cabinet with a skull in it or whatever.
Digital.
That's all digital.
Yep. Including the skulls and everything else. Yep. That's all 100% CG.
So
yep.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It's rad.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was impressive.
Because I would not have known.
Honestly. I mean, and it's honestly, it's not easy. And it took us a long time to get those big moments, to get them right.
Yeah.
Was tricky. Yep. Because the sim, you know, when you're simming that, now you've got
the actors did get thrown.
Without question. Yeah. The stunt performers get thrown into stuff and they do the role. They do the whole thing.
So did they get thrown into like a box or something?
In those cases, no, they just get thrown into it. And basically there's no resistance because there's nothing there.
Right. So that's how they just go right through it.
They go right through it. Yeah.
Okay.
But luckily it happens quickly enough
right.
to where you don't pick up that there's glass that would be resisting them. It just breaks.
And it just explodes.
Yeah. And it looks cool.
It does.
So we all get away with a little bit because it's fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It works.
Yeah.
Anything that deals with that kind of, like, because I know this, like having, you know, worked on the Tron thing, like I mentioned, and that was a long, long time ago, obviously.
It's not that much easier. It's just your computers are faster.
Yeah. But it's hard. It's really hard. Super sharp reflections like that is really hard to make it look. But the set was beautiful. Like some of those shots, dude, Alex. Like,
yeah, it came out great.
It's so cool to design something for almost a year and then walk around in something like that. Cause it's a whole year of your life almost where you're kind of going back to it. Like we said, the levels, there was a 3-4 levels to it, then 3 levels.
Right.
There was budgetary issues to where it was going to be really small and like much smaller than it ended up. And then it got bigger. And to actually walk around in that thing, it was so surreal to see all that. It was really cool.
A couple things I'm going to note about this because I think it's absolutely beautiful. It is definitely an incredible piece of architecture and should be revered as incredible design, right? Mm-hmm.
Melted down.
Melted.
Is it true that a lot of the glass just kind of went with the crew or what happened to all that glass? That's one of my questions.
They melted it down.
Did they really?
Yeah. Oh. Yep.
Okay. Which is brings me, you're right on target with what I'm about to talk about because used to be, I was an architect. I worked in architecture, et cetera. And everyone is like, well, you know, architecture is real. It's exists, et cetera, et cetera. Right. I was an intern as an architect and I worked on a project and it was really cool. It was in New York also. And it was a lot of glass, interestingly as well. I made this big glass atrium thing. And I was incredibly fortunate. I worked at Fox and Fowle Architects, which are a really great architecture firm. I was incredibly fortunate that they put me on a design team and I guess I excelled at it. And I did some CG renders of glass and it was like, and that's what sold them on building this glass structure in front of it. And I was like, this is awesome. Right. They built it. It got built and I got to see it in person. I'm like, wow, look at that.
It's very cool.
It's cool. They tore down that building. So that building doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Right. And I'm thinking about it and I'm like, first of all, I guess I don't know how many people saw it or noticed that building that walk around New York. Probably, a lot of people, right? But it's gone, and then no one's going to remember that building. Mm-hmm. They melted down all the glass, so the structure that you designed doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
But it exists forever in that film.
Correct.
It's true.
Right? Yeah. And so people are going to see it as the way it was built in that film, and that's going to be the design that you made. So you can always say that's something that I helped envision, you know?
Yeah.
And that is architecture in a lot of ways. And I think that some people don't sort of give credit to that. Now, by the way, Another thing is no one's going to build a building like that in real life because it's not safe.
It's well, you know what one of the references for it was the Apple building in New York also.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because there's that big giant glass cube.
Yeah, but yes, sure.
But not the same. Yeah.
No one's going to have that amount of glass everywhere on everything and look as cool as that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really cool to design things that are like, looks good on film, and then it'll always be on film, right?
I think somebody could actually build something now. Now that somebody's done this work, I bet somebody could actually build a building like this.
Yeah,
I mean, or at least a couple of. If your building comes
with a bunch of Ouija people, I guess.
It's just somebody cleaning it all the time.
Oh my God, boy. Smudgeville.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
but that for me, like in the art department, is the like most rewarding thing is to walk around in something that you've designed. Like it's just, yeah, there's something cool. I've done it on a couple films now, and to just walk these places and, you know, come up with an idea and then physically be in that space. Just it's still like the first day of work for me. It's so awesome.
Yeah.
When I was in VFX a long time, for like 10 years, I was in VFX, and then going into the art department and doing this, I really enjoy a lot of the set design stuff that I've been doing the past few years.
Yeah. I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine. I think it's really cool to be able to think about that and think about the world of designing. I also think it's interesting that you came from visual effects, right? So you and Rob probably spoke the same language. You were thinking about like, am I going to make a nightmare situation for Rob, right?
But he shouldn't have to care about that.
He shouldn't. He shouldn't.
I'll speak for you. I don't think you did. I don't think you made concessions for us.
I mean,
No. I don't think you're making concessions. In fact, I think being understanding of each other is important.
Sure.
Like you're not saying I'm going to make it. It's like, you know what? Because sometimes if you think about like how it's going to work on set, you sometimes can come up with even more creative ideas of like, you know, it could be really cool or you know, it could look really cool or how to think about this set extension. You know, you thought about it in VR, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I mean, Rob's amazing when he comes by. It's always, I will make it work, which is really cool.
Right.
Like, and he comes in and it's not like, here's the design, see what you can do. It's a collaboration. So it's always a conversation that's going on for months and months. And then by the end, it's not just one person's thing. It's like 100 people's things, which is so cool. It was an incredible feat of cooperation between all the departments and all the people and like construction. Even the VR scene was actually crazy. One of the things that I kind of market around with the VR stuff is that even the construction crew that built the physical set on the soundstage came over to VR and then put the headset on to walk around in the set and then got down on the ground because everything's to scale and walked and then crawled underneath the building and then decided where they'd lay the wiring for the lighting in the scene.
Right.
So it's just a crazy collaboration between all the different departments.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense too. Yeah, I think, basically, you know, what you guys did was a lot of what architects do, right? And taking advantage of that and going into VR was actually the same thing, right? Like, okay, this is how it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of how it's going to work. Did you guys use any of the VR in this? You probably didn't.
I mean, we ended up getting your set.
Mm-hmm. Like
we grabbed his model, and that only happens because I know him.
Right.
Normally that kind of transfer doesn't happen that easily.
No.
And you did a lot of the ray tracing tests and everything, the lighting tests to figure out what would work and what wouldn't work.
Yeah. So I went and I pulled his model into V-Ray.
Right.
And on my little laptop, which I think I basically killed my Surface laptop a couple of times by trying to render on that thing. And when I did that, it's like, okay, this can work, this can't work. What kind of reflections do we truly see after putting in the translight and all that stuff? And that helped inform the director of photography approximately the kind of reflections he would get.
Right.
You know, obviously the real ones are a little bit different, as we know that they always will be, but I'm getting, if I get in the 90th percentile of accuracy,
There's no reason why you can't.
Yeah.
Like ray tracing. It's physical, right?
Exactly. But like, I won't go, you know, the 1,000 bounces of ray casting to, you know,
well,
to
no, get because reflection it'll, depth. It'll die down after a while. Yeah. It keeps,
So I dropped it because I was on a laptop with 16 gigs of RAM, man. Like I had all kinds of trouble rendering on that thing.
I'm going to show you a laptop after this. You're going to be jealous.
I almost set that thing on fire a few times.
Oh, I'm sure.
Sometimes metaphorically, sometimes actually.
Oh boy. Yeah, one of the other things about the house too is that the lighting changes in the project. Because when he first goes in, because the lights are
off. They flip the switches. Yeah. And actually that's another thing that I thought was beautiful about that. They flip the switches and the whole thing changes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's that giant video wall back there.
Oh, right.
Along with the Carl F. Booker advertisement that is outside the window.
Yeah. Right.
That you designed that at some point.
I put it in as a suggestion and it ended up being in there.
Yeah.
It was really cool. but what was cool about also in the VR thing is that I set up for the cinematographer on the VR controller, the Vive controller.
Yeah.
I placed the LED lights how he wanted it. So he came and sat at my desk and told me how he wanted the lights. Uh-huh. I plugged that in Blueprint in Unreal Engine. And then so you hit a button and it would turn the lights on and off.
So he could see what it would look
like. Yeah, so he'd walk around in there and he'd basically turn the lights on and off. And he was like deciding if he wanted horizontal lines on the floor versus vertical ones on the pillars and everything.
Right.
And so that was really cool to like give that interactivity on the controller for him to be able to do that too.
Right.
So, that was really neat to be able to do the different lighting scenarios too.
Okay. So from you worked on the design of that for like a year?
Saying? Along with other sets also.
With other sets,
yeah, obviously. I was in there doing the Glasshouse VR development at the same time as doing like the China sushi restaurant in Chinatown. Right. And then I did a bunch of sets in the place. So I was kind of bouncing around doing everything.
How long did it take him to build that set?
The glass office set?
Yeah.
2.5 months, 10 weeks.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Right around 10 weeks.
Okay.
So it was always up in the air.
They built it on a soundstage.
Yeah, they built it on a soundstage.
It was up in the air because of the tariffs on steel that were going up and down during that time also, if you remember.
Yes.
So the budget would constantly change, which was part of the thing too.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Okay. All right. How many days on set? For that, that's going
to
be a big one.
We were supposed to spend 3 days on set.
No,
however,
no,
we shot there for 9.
Yeah. Oof, that still seems low.
We shot there for 9.
Because there's a lot of shit that goes on in that set.
Yep. And there's about 2 minutes, 15 seconds of a fight scene that has been cut out of that scene.
Right.
That you don't see. There's a lot of fighting that happens in there.
Yeah, there is. Like,
a lot. But there's way more than the audience has ever seen in the movie because it was cut out. Because after a while, it's like, okay, we get it. You're fighting people in a glass thing and you can't see people.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot more lower level fighting before he goes upstairs to fight Yayan and Chachap.
Yeah.
Yep.
Interesting. All right. Well, that is amazing. Okay, so we're kind of rounding up about an hour, but I want to say, is there any other interesting stories that you guys want to talk about that you guys worked on together on this film that we can share with our audiences?
I don't have anything that I worked on with him with, but I do want to hear about some of the bridge sequence because that was such an incredible.
The motorcycle.
Yeah.
Yeah. The bike chase was.
Yeah. That thing was pretty cool. There's a couple of things that we did and I'll talk about that in a second, but I just want to go over one thing. So there's a lot of things that visual effects does that nobody ever notices, which I love. I love when people don't know.
That's the point of our jobs.
That is exactly the idea, right? If I
that's
see
the problem effects, I have is like if no one knows that we didn't do anything, then we've succeeded, and therefore no one knows that we did anything.
And like the irony of all of that is that's why a lot of times the visual effects department doesn't get any as much credo on set and as much respect on set, only because people don't know what we do, and everything we do is so black boxy and weird,
right,
and is only a very small subset of the filmmaking population that does any of the work and actually understands it,
right,
and knows what we need. That is like a whole other situation. But for example, the horse chase. So when the motorcycle's on the horse chasing the horse, the horses are not allowed to run on concrete. It's not good for them.
No. Yeah.
So as a result, horse mats like you would use in a barn were placed all along the street.
It's kind of. Okay.
Yep. So we had to replace the horse mats with actual street. Luckily,
of course,
we scanned it. We photogrammetried it. We took photography. We did everything. We did the usual thing.
Right.
I was a real scumbag about it, where our guys would go in and scan everything. I said, scan everything. If a camera is going to drop in there, I want you to scan it.
Sure.
I want to be able to build this thing to like within a half centimeter of accuracy.
Yep.
And so I had a LiDAR guy who was excellent, who came and just scanned everything. And so there were a lot of times when somebody said, oh, we got this problem. I said, don't worry, I got a scan. Oh, I can solve everything with scans. Because sure. I can literally solve any problem, just about any problem, if I have enough scan data and HDRI and photogrammetry.
Right.
So we ended up recreating, once again, Method Australia came in and they recreated the entire street of that whole thing, including reflections of motorcycles, reflections of the horse, reflections of cars with lights on,
yep.
people, the whole thing. They recreated that from nothing. And one of the first shots we ever got back from them was a kind of a test of that. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about a glossy, reflective surface that has to be like kind of wet, kind of dry. It's actually a difficult shader to pull off well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah.
challenging. Like that's one of those hard things to make yep. it look real.
Yep.
Not photoreal, actually real.
Yep.
And they did a damn good job. Mm-hmm. And I was showing it. I remember I was in Morocco and I was talking to Halle Berry about something and she's like, oh, visual effects, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, let me show you something that you would never think about doing with visual effects. And I showed her one of the shots and she goes, show it again.
Right.
And I did. And she goes, wow, I would never think that you guys would have to do that. And I said, here's why. She goes, oh, well, I wouldn't think about the horse. It's just not something I think about. But that's, and I said, well, my goal is that you don't know that we're there. My goal is that you know that I'm there on set to help you.
Right.
You as a filmmaker, you know, when you do your first project, whatever it is, my goal is to help you as a filmmaker.
Right.
I'm a crayon inside the art tools that you have at your disposal.
Right.
And, you know, let me just help along with the other crayons. I'm not the only crayon. It's a lot of crayons, right? But
isn't that a little bit the dilemma? Because the whole point is that people don't know. But that at the same time, people keep bashing CG for being the reason why movie sucks is because of CG. And this is better because they don't use CG. And they don't realize when they say that it's all CG that they're looking at. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of that. And some of that is just purely based on time, right? At some point, if you give an incredibly talented visual effects team 4 weeks to do a certain thing, it's just not going to look good because they don't have the time they need to execute properly.
Okay.
For example, now let's talk about the motorcycle chase. It's a little dovetailing here.
Sure.
So the motorcycle chase, we turned that over to our vendor Image Engine in August of 2018.
Okay.
And we delivered it in March of 2019. You're talking 2 total minutes of footage, approximately 215, somewhere around there. And it took them a long, quote unquote, a long time. It's the hardest thing I've ever worked on. Without question.
The motorcycles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because if it doesn't look photographic, again, not photoreal, if it doesn't look photographic, the audience, the John Wick audience, which is expecting photography for the whole movie.
Right.
As I am, as an audience member, I expect photography. And if we don't give them that, they get pulled out of the film. And the first thing they'll do is go on Reddit and complain about it. As they should, by the way.
Yes.
If it's a problem, complain about it and people will make adjustments. And so we spent a lot of time working with the super talented team at Image Engine to make sure that they had everything we needed. And we shot actual background plates with an array car. We, of course,
shut down the bridge.
We shut down the bridge for 3 nights from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m.
Oh, my God. That must have pissed off a lot of New Yorkers.
Luckily, the Verrazano Bridge
is not as busy.
It's about a 2-mile bridge, and it connects Brooklyn and Staten Island.
Yeah.
So the good news is from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m., there's not that many people traveling between those two parts of those cities.
Okay.
And it has a top level and a lower level. We shot on the lower level, so the top level was open. So people could go through. Maybe there was a little bit of a slowdown. It never looked like a problem when I would see what was going on. Like traffic was being diverted, but it's not like there were millions and millions of people trying to cross that bridge.
Right.
The issue with that was that we couldn't set foot on the bridge until 9 p.m. And we had to be completely off, the entire company gone, ghost by 5 a.m.
Right.
But it took an hour to prep and an hour to strike.
Right.
So now you don't actually have from 9 to 5.
You have from
10 to 4.
Right.
But then you just want to be safe. So really you have about till about 3:30.
Right.
Because you don't want to mess up and all of a sudden they shut the whole production down because you went over by 1 minute.
So you only have about 5 hours.
5 hours and you have to do wrecks of motorcycles that you're shooting.
Right.
Tricky. Very, very tricky.
Right.
And we have to shoot plates and we have to do HDRIs and we have to do LiDAR and we have to do photogrammetry and we have to do actual photography of different signs and different bits and to make
a lot of planning.
Tons and tons and tons of planning. We shot that sequence 4 times before we actually shot it.
Right.
The stunt department, they stunt viz everything. Yeah. And so they did stunt viz the first time. And then I went into the stunt department where they were rehearsing near our production offices. And I went in there and I took a look and I was like, ooh, this is going to be cool. And then we walked through some stuff and they had these sleds that they had built with these motorcycles and they were pushing it around and dudes are going to be in green suits and the whole thing. And I looked at it and I said, hey guys, have you measured out the size of the bridge? They said, yeah, it's cool. Okay. So then they did another one because they had to make some adjustments. And I said, well, hold on. Have you measured it? And have you actually made the lane lines the right measurements for the bridge? They said, well, the standard lane line is X amount of feet. I don't actually know those numbers. Right. Let's say 9 feet, whatever. And right. I said, okay, but is that the actual size from the Verrazano Bridge?
Right.
And nobody knew. And I said, hold on a second. So I called locations and I had locations bring our guy, our LiDAR guy, John Ashby. I had him bring him to the bridge and stand at some point while traffic was going and scan the bridge, like one little tiny section, just one scan.
Right.
But it was enough to get us the distances.
Right.
Because of how accurate those LiDAR kits are. We found out that they were off by about 1 to 1.5 feet in certain places. And if you're choreographing 6 motorcycles that have to intertwine, 1.5 feet is a big deal.
Yeah.
And so they had to redo it again. So they redid it. And then we said, okay, well, what happens if we actually, let's test it out. And so we did a big test where we actually put a big green screen on a much smaller stage and had the right sizing. We looked at it and went, that's not working. Then we shot it again the next day, same green screen. And then we had somebody actually comp in the background plates from the running footage that we had shot just to see, does this work?
Yeah.
Is this even functional? And the answer was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah, it looks that this is going to be rad.
Right.
You know, what happens when Keanu Reeves gets out a sword and starts kicking butt, taking names all over the place.
Right.
But then, yeah, we ended up, Image Engine ended up rebuilding the entire bridge as a digital asset.
It had to be.
An incredibly detailed thing.
It had to be, only logistically speaking, it looked photographic, as you say.
Yeah. And for a long time, everybody said, oh, we're going to photograph the bridge. And I said, yes, we're going to get a camera. We're going to shoot, do an array. And I set up the array thing. We will have photography of this. We will do it at multiple speeds. We will do it at this, multiple lanes, the whole thing. And in the back of my head, and I remember telling my producer, I was like, we will never use this photography. It will never be in the movie.
Right. Yeah.
And he's like, Bobo, come on, man. We're going to use the photography. I said, have you heard of parallax? Because there is no way this will ever work.
Right.
There is no way to take 12 array camera
right.
and project it onto geometry of a bridge and then refilm it. It's just, it cannot work.
Right.
Best case scenario, we're replacing the ground. Well, if we're replacing the ground, you replace the whole damn thing. Because at that point, everything has to lock together. Well, that's not going to work. If you're doing projections, you're going to miss a spot and it's going to be weird. So Image Engine had to build that bridge.
So they built all of it.
They built all of it. And then we saw a bridge turntable or a driving. They took one of our shots that we had a test of a guy in a motorcycle with a black suit on, the black helmet, actually riding down at about 15, 20 miles an hour, riding down the bridge.
Right.
They took that exact shot and they recreated a digital version of it.
And it was to show you couldn't tell the difference.
Yes.
Right?
And at that point, when we saw it, we were like, okay, yeah, there's some shader stuff on the helmet, et cetera, and sadly for them, I knew too much about shading with my background. So I was giving very specific detailed notes about how shader is supposed to work.
Right.
Probably to everybody's chagrin on that show. At any rate, but they ended up nailing it and the bridge came out fantastically good.
Yeah.
And even though everybody knows it's digital because you just can't.
There's no way.
Nobody's fighting dudes on motorcycles on a freaking bridge. Nobody would do that. It doesn't bump for anybody.
No, it doesn't.
And that's the other part of my job is I got to keep the audience engaged.
Where it bumps is that they make it to the bridge from the New York Public Library in 5 frames.
That's right. Yeah. No. And anybody who sees what's going on and realizes what bridge it is knows that there's no, wait a minute, that's not the Brooklyn Bridge.
Right.
That's the Verrazano Bridge. This is way too long. What's happening?
It would take a half an hour to get there.
Yeah. Easily. Yeah. Easily.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of geographic issues, but you know what? It's John Wick. Nobody cares.
No one cares.
Yeah.
It's a different universe anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's different. Well, anyway, this has been fascinating, guys. I really appreciate you guys sharing the story and getting to know this world and being part of it. I can't wait to talk about this on Martini Giant and actually get into the John Wick world a little bit more, but just the making of is really cool. So I really appreciate, you know, I've known you guys for years and being able to see your guys' work that looks so cool that on screen was really awesome. Really awesome.
Thanks, cheers, man. Yeah.
Yeah. I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot for being here.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, man.